Court's ready to hear argument in McNally versus State. Are you ready to proceed?
Sounds right, Your Honor.
Mr. Howard.
May it please the Court. I'm Kevin Howard here. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Troy McNally. I was not trial counsel in this matter. Mr. McNally was represented by the public defender at that time. But I've been asked to handle this appeal. Members of the Court.
That notation relates to the standard of review.
No, Your Honor. It relates to some 1,800-odd pages of transcript that I had to leaf through with no idea where I was going at the start. But I did, however, find some things in there that I thought might interest the Court and things that I included in my brief that I believe warrant the Court's attention. I made three arguments. The facts of this case are covered in the briefs, and I compliment Mr. Williams. His statement of facts is more thorough than mine, but I've essentially tried to set them out. Mr. McNally was basically charged with offenses related to a circumstance where he discharged a firearm. It was alleged that he discharged a firearm at a residence, and he was convicted of weapons offenses and endangering offenses in connection with that event. During the course of his trial, the state introduced ballistic evidence to establish that certain shell casings located at the scene of the crime matched shell casings that were located in an automobile that Mr. McNally was known to operate, and indeed it was evidence he had operated that particular vehicle on the day of this crime. The state also offered forensic evidence in the form of expert testimony concerning gunshot residue, and that particular aspect of the case occupied hundreds of pages of transcript. Mr. McNally's hands were swabbed on the evening of this event, as well as a portion of the vehicle it was alleged that he had driven, and those swabs were analyzed for gunshot residue. In any event, Mr. McNally was convicted at trial, and I've identified three issues for the Court to consider. The first issue in my brief concerns the instruction that was given by the trial judge in connection with the presumption of innocence and reasonable doubt. This instruction was not objected to at trial, and the standard review as far as appellate's concerned would be plain error. The instruction is an instruction that has been given on previous occasions. Indeed, this Court took a look at this instruction for other reasons in another case. But there's a portion of the instruction that in my own practice I have regularly objected to and recently have convinced several trial judges to change. That instruction is five paragraphs, and I focus the Court's attention on the last two paragraphs. The first portion of the instruction talks about the presumption of innocence, and that's not really something that we're challenging in connection with this appeal. But the last two paragraphs, there's a phrase that's used to identify sort of the quantum of proof that rises to the level of reasonable doubt. And the trial courts routinely use the word firmly convinced. It's evidence which should firmly convince you. If you are firmly convinced of something, then that's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that makes sense. And in my in recent cases, I've asked the Court to say an instruction.
Yeah, Mr. Howard, I'm waiting with bated breath for you to tell us what the error was.
I'm happy to move right to that, Your Honor. In the last paragraph of the instruction, it's quoted in my brief. The Court first says that if you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charge, you should find the defendant guilty. If, on the other hand, you think there is a real possibility, or in other words, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, you must give the defendant the benefit of that doubt by finding the defendant not guilty. The Court suggests to the jury in that sentence that they have to have a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty. And just before that, the Court suggests that the quantum of proof for that is to be firmly convinced of something. So now the trial judge is suggesting to the jury they have to be firmly convinced that the defendant is not guilty in order to find him not guilty. of instruction.
I'm confused because when I read this, it seemed to say you have to be firmly convinced that he's guilty. Nowhere in the instruction does it say you have to be firmly convinced that he's not guilty, right?
That's correct.
So how are you putting this together to make it a firmly convinced that there's a reasonable doubt?
By the court instructing the jury that in order to find the defendant not guilty, they have to have a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty. They have to be firmly convinced that the defendant is not guilty. The court's previous...
Well, wait a second. How does reasonable doubt mean firmly convinced?
It says it in instruction, Madam Justice, that the court defines the quantum of proof to establish the threshold of reasonable doubt as being firmly convinced.
Well, isn't he saying reasonable doubt is real possibility?
And then, instead of stopping there and suggesting to the jury, if you think there is a real possibility that the defendant is not guilty, you must give him the benefit of the doubt, this phrase is inserted.
Isn't the problem there the word not? Why would you have a reasonable doubt about him being not guilty? You'd have a reasonable doubt that he was guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor. If the instruction simply said that a real possibility, or in other words, a reasonable doubt, then you must find the defendant not guilty. If the instruction said that, I wouldn't have raised the issue. And I have offered in Superior Court cases basically the alternative instruction that says if you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty, then you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If you are not firmly convinced, then you must find the defendant not guilty. It's a simple alternative. That phrase, that word, the not, that appears in that instruction creates confusion and contradicts previous language of the instruction where the trial judge says to the jury, it's evidence more than a probability. It can't be based on a probability.
Well, I don't understand the sentence with the word not in it.
I don't either, Your Honor. I don't understand the sentence, and I don't understand why the jury is directed back to the phrase reasonable doubt when they're talking about the alternative of finding the defendant not guilty either. And that's my problem with the instruction. It is confusing, and the court requires that if you're going to try and define reasonable doubt for the jury, you have to do it in a way that is effective. It's not misleading. It doesn't create confusion, and that didn't happen in this case.
Well, what exactly is the confusion here, or the risk of confusion?
The risk of confusion is that the juries will say, okay, in this instruction the court has told us that reasonable doubt, to reach the threshold, the state has proof beyond a reasonable doubt when I'm firmly convinced. And then in this instruction they say that you can find the defendant not guilty if you have a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty. In other words, you have to be firmly convinced that he's not guilty. That's where the confusion was.
So you're equating, or at least taking the position, that the juxtaposition of the sentences somehow equates firmly convinced with reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact,
how do you get there?
In the previous paragraph, I'll quote, proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced. In order to find the defendant not guilty, you must have a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty. That's what the phrase says. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced. It's a phrase that's in the instruction. It's in the previous paragraph. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced. And then the jury's told, if on the other hand you think there is a real possibility, or in other words, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, you must give the defendant the benefit of the doubt. That phrase has no place in the instruction.
What about the Mills decision?
In the Mills decision, it didn't address the concern that I'm raising here, but if you look at Mills, and I cited the instruction that the court looked to with approval in Mills, an instruction that had been sanctioned by the United States Supreme Court in Victor versus Nebraska, In that instruction, the comparable language is set out like this. If, based on your consideration of the evidence, you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charged, you must find him guilty. If, on the other hand, you think there is a real possibility that he is not guilty, you must give him the benefit of the doubt and find him not guilty. That's the instruction the United States Supreme Court said met constitutional muster.
Well, what about the decision, the language in Mills, though, the jury instruction?
The Mills court didn't concern itself with the phrase that I'm identifying for you as a problem.
Right, but Justice Holland expressed concern about the phrase, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, and suggested that a more appropriate way to word that would be a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty.
I agree with that.
Okay, but didn't the Mills court say a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty is acceptable language?
It said that the instruction was acceptable. It did not deal with that aspect of the instruction. There was another specific aspect of the instruction that the Mills court dealt with, not this phrase.
Well, even if, and it would seem, that the choice of words here was infelicitous. It certainly wouldn't be the ideal formulation. Does it follow from that that the jury was misled?
Yes, Your Honor, I think they were, because they could construe that instruction as requiring them to be firmly convinced that the defendant was not guilty before they reached that decision.
Okay, and what I'm missing here is the chain of logic that gets you to that, or that would get the jury to that construction.
The chain of logic comes from the previous paragraph, where the court says, proof beyond the reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced. If that is the quantum of proof for beyond a reasonable doubt, and then the judge tells the jury, if, on the other hand, you think there is a reasonable possibility, or in other words, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, it's telling the jury that you can find him not guilty if you're firmly convinced he's not guilty. That's the logic. And I don't know about
that. And how is that misleading?
It's not an accurate statement of the law, because the jury doesn't have to be firmly convinced of the defendant's innocence. The jury can find the defendant right. Not guilty, even if they think he probably did it.
Right, but the nowhere does the instruction say that the jury has to be firmly convinced that the defendant is innocent.
That is correct. That is correct. I'm directing the court to the language in the instruction, which I believe creates the confusion.
Right.
But it does not use that phrase. And fortunately,
but you're saying that the instruction as given somehow could mislead the jury into thinking that is what it would have to find.
That's correct. The second argument that I want to address concerns the ballistics or tool mark evidence that was addressed in the trial. Again, the evidence that I'm talking to you about was not objected to at trial.
Well, isn't that fatal to this type of a claim? What you're saying is that there wasn't enough, there wasn't the kind of gatekeeping analysis that should have been done by the court before it was admitted, right?
That's part of my argument, yes, Your Honor.
Sua sponte.
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason why in this particular case that it would have been appropriate is because the expert rendered his opinion without foundation, basically blurting it out early on in his testimony, only to later on during the course of the trial be unable to recall the data on which he based his opinion.
So that's why you make the argument it's like Fenster.
That's correct, and it rises to the level of a violation of the defendant's right to confront the witness. In Fensterer, I'm sure you're all well aware, an FBI agent testified that a hair follicle was forcibly removed, and he cited the three potential theories or techniques in which you could make that determination.
And when he was asked at trial, well, which technique did you use, he couldn't remember. And what this court says, well, the defendant was then deprived of his ability to cross-examine the expert on his conclusion and his opinion because he didn't have a recollection of how he reached it. In this case, what happened is the tool mark expert simply stated that he, in all fairness, he said, I used a microscope to make comparisons. My conclusion based on those comparisons that all of these shell casings came from the same firearm. That was his conclusion. He was asked by trial counsel, defense counsel, well, can you direct our attention to the marks on these particular shell casings which led you to that conclusion? And he said that he could not remember. In addition to that, when he came to court without diagrams, without photographs, without any demonstrable way to show that there were marks on these various shell casings which corresponded and which could lead him to reach that conclusion. His own professional association, I've cited to the cases that recite the standards, require for an expert in that particular category, practicing in that field, to do just that, to document his work with photographs or notes, pictographs, and to indeed have his conclusions evaluated by a second examiner to make sure that they're reproducible. And that didn't happen in this case. The Fensterer issue, I believe, is a constitutional issue. How could his trial counsel cross-examine him about his conclusions or his methodology if he couldn't remember what he based it on, other than in a general sense?
What, in your view, should the court have done sua sponte?
There are two issues here. I believe it was plain error for the court not to step in sua sponte. Once the trial judge heard that the expert witness could not recall the markings that he relied on to reach his conclusion, that he could not direct the jury or the judge to the basis of his opinion. What I believe the trial judge should have done at that point was he should have sent the jury out, and at that point there should have been a voir dire concerning this issue.
Well, how would a judge know that this simply was not trial strategy, that I'm just not going to object?
I don't know if a trial judge would know that, Your Honor.
But what you're advocating is that we find it was reversible error for the judge not to step in.
That's correct, Your Honor, because of the importance of the evidence. This particular aspect of the case placed the defendant not only at the scene, but placed the gun in his hand.
Okay, so there should have been a voir dire.
There should have been some
delay,
way.
And I gather you didn't. These aren't your words, but I understand what you're saying is that the voir dire would have laid the foundation for a possible motion to strike the witness's testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're into your rebuttal time. You have 3.5 minutes left.
I want to briefly touch on chain of custody. In this case, there was a gunshot residue evidence collected from the defendant's hands in a car. The collection mechanism, if you'll picture, it's like a bottle cap, and it has a swab on the exterior. And the police officer or technician swabs the hand or the surface and inserts it in a vial. And then it's transmitted to be analyzed. In this particular case, the trial counsel made a request for all witnesses in the chain of custody. Now, in the context of drug cases, that means anybody who actually touches the substance, not just the packaging. It came to light during the course of the trial that a forensic technician or chemist at the testing agency was, other than the witness who testified, was responsible for removing the vials from the stored locker, removing the stubs, which actually contained the items to be analyzed, the substance, the gunshot residue, and loaded those items in an electron microscope. In other words, that person is the person who exposed the substance to be tested to the laboratory conditions that existed, and that person had a protocol to meet. And this particular lab, 90% of their work was gunshot residue analysis. That person did not appear. If it were a drug case, that person would be specifically covered by the chain of custody statute because that individual touched, held, processed the actual thing to be tested. But this is not a drug case, but the analysis is or the analogy is clear. This is not somebody who simply handled packaging. They touched the substance, and they were unavailable to be questioned about their role in the analysis, whether they dropped the sample, whether they indeed followed the protocol, whether they had done other testing where they had handled items with gunshot residue. Was there a risk of contamination and how they went about their business? The trial court simply reached the conclusion that there was no adulteration without knowing what that person would have said. And that person was specifically requested by the defense. It's a huge breach in the chain of custody. And it was permitted in this particular case, and the expert was allowed to render her opinion.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court, I'll attempt to address the issues in the order that they appeared in the brief and as were presented today. The state's position is that this reasonable doubt presumption of innocence jury instruction has to be analyzed in its totality. And if you look at the entire five-paragraph instruction, it's at page B73 of the state's appendix. It says in there the jury's explicitly told that the burden of proof is upon the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the facts necessary to establish each and every element of each crime charged. The jury in this case was also instructed that proof that a defendant is probably guilty is not sufficient. Looking at the totality of the instruction, I'm not sure why that word not is in the last paragraph. It doesn't seem to make much sense to me either, but that's how the instruction was worded in Mills. I think it's at page 852 of the reported decision. So it's been around for at least 10 years. I had done the Mills case 10 years ago and really hadn't focused on that, and that hadn't come up before. I'm not sure why it says not guilty. It seems to make a whole lot more sense if it just said left out nod and just said guilty. But anyway,
I know that in the Superior Court's working on pattern instructions, and they have pattern civil instructions. How far have they gotten with pattern criminal instructions?
Well, I know that's been a work in progress. I don't know what the target date is for completion. They're not done. There's a collection of the pattern instructions. In fact, I put a couple of pattern instructions in the state's appendix, and it looks like this is a combination of some of the language that was in two pattern instructions, but it's not an exact combination. It does appear that this is a similar instruction, however, to what was analyzed in the Mills case.
So how would you characterize what Mills said about these words, that it simply wasn't the focus of the opinion, or did Mills say that the sentence with the word not in it was proper?
Well, I don't think it was the focus of the opinion because it doesn't really address not and that word not in the fifth paragraph there. And I did do the Mills case, and it's 10 years ago, and I don't remember a lot, but I don't remember that.
The reason I'm asking should be obvious. If, you know, we don't talk to each other, so we have no idea what the three members of this panel think about this particular case. But while we're all together, my question for you is, if we were to decide the word not shouldn't be in there, do we have to overrule Mills, or do we distinguish it, or simply say it wasn't addressed?
Well, I think probably the last alternative, that it just wasn't addressed. It seems to me that what McNally is arguing for is to take language from the fourth paragraph, this firmly convinced, and moving that down or substituting that for somewhat different language in paragraph 5, and I don't think that's really justified. I think if you look at the totality in the instruction. It doesn't shift the burden of proof. It doesn't affect the presumption of innocence, and it doesn't place any greater burden upon the defendant in this particular case.
Well, as I understand what Mr. Howard said, so I'll give you my understanding, and so you'll have to react to my characterization. He said the first paragraph says a reasonable doubt is a firm conviction. And then he gets down to the language at issue, and he, to paraphrase what I think he's arguing, is if you have a reasonable doubt, paren, firm conviction, that the defendant is not guilty. And that's what causes the confusion. Is that the way you understand his argument?
Yes, I think so. I think what he's saying is take this firmly convinced language, that phrase in paragraph 4, and if you substitute that down to where it's talking about the language in their reasonable doubt in paragraph 5, that if you switch those or insert one, that then that makes it defective because you are now placing a burden upon the defendant, and the defendant has no burden of proof in a criminal case. But I don't think that's justified, and it certainly contradicts other explicit language earlier on in the instruction. And if you read,
your position is that to the extent that's not the model way to instruct the jury, our law says you look at everything in context, and there's no way this inartful language denied a jury the ability to discharge its function.
Yes, I think that's correct. This court in Flore, the year before Mills was decided, said that jury instructions have to be reviewed as a whole, and no statement is to be viewed in a vacuum, is what Flore said. And I think that's apropos here, that if you look at the entirety of the instruction, it's clear to the jury that the burden of proof is upon the state in this particular case, and that the defendant does not have a burden. He is presumed innocent. The second issue is also a plain error claim about Mr. Roan, who was the ballistics examiner. And there were really three appellate claims. One was that the witness, Carl Roan, was simply not qualified to give an expert opinion. The record is that he was the individual who had microscopically examined these seven cartridges and determined that they were two things, one .45 caliber, and then second, that the four cartridges found at the shooting scene were similar to the three cartridges, these are spent cartridges, that were found inside of the motor vehicle that Mr. McNally was driving at least at some point during the day when the shooting occurred. He had prior experience. He had been an examiner, I think firearms examiner in Philadelphia for approximately 20 years. He testified to his training both at the Philadelphia PD and with the military at Fort Dix as well as the FBI. So I think he was certainly a qualified individual to give an expert opinion. Here,
I think Mr. Howard's real focus is on the Fensterer claim. And you know, as he characterized it, that this is a case like Fensterer where you couldn't cross-examine, therefore you have a constitutional violation. As I understand your argument, the expert got enough of a basis in for his testimony that this type of deficiency is something that you would develop on cross and it would go to weight and there would be no constitutional violation.
Yes, that's a correct characterization of the state's argument, is that what Mr. Roan said, he had examined these shell casings approximately 9 months earlier, and he was asked which serrations had he determined to be significant in order to compare one shell casing to another and say, yes, these were all fired by the same firearm. And he couldn't recall exactly which lands and grooves or whatever they were called, serrations on the shell casings were significant to him. However, I think that's different than the follicular tag evidence that this court dealt with in Fensterer. Fensterer was that a case where there was a cat leash that was thought to be the murder weapon, that the individual had been strangled with a cat leash, and there were, I think, two hairs that were detected on the cat leash. And the question that became at trial was, well, I think there was evidence that these tags, the skin tags that were attached to the hairs, showed that some force had been applied and that forcibly these hairs had been removed from the victim's body by use of the cat leash. And there were three potential theories as to the follicular tag evidence, and the expert witness in Fenster could not recall which of the three theories he had specifically relied upon to conclude that this cat leash had been used to forcibly remove a hair tag.
And how is that, now how is this case different qualitatively from what occurred in Fenster?
Well, here I don't think there's any difference in theory. He's just saying that I match up these lands and grooves, these markings on the shell casings. All I can't remember is exactly which serration or land and groove it is, but there's just one theory. That's certainly fodder for cross-examination. They can ask him, well, now you really can't remember what you saw now, can you, because you can't tell us which one it is. And the defense certainly had the opportunity to do that, and I think that's what the confrontation right requires, and that was met in this particular case.
So the qualitative difference is that in Fenster, jury wasn't told of the theory, you know, that underlay the entire testimony or opinion of the expert. Here, there was no question as to the theory. It was just a question of the evidentiary detail.
Yes, which physical
applying the theory to the facts. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, it was which particular lands and grooves did he think were significant, and could he point to one and say, you know, if you look at this other one microscopically, they two match up. That was what he couldn't recall, and I don't know that that's all that surprising if he didn't have photographs at that point.
Well, I wanted to get to that issue. Apparently, this expert showed up and was just winging it, and I don't mean it quite as negatively as it sounds, but no report, no photographs, no diagrams even of, you know, here's what the shell casings looked like, and there were little stripes or big stripes or whatever on them. So the state was taking a pretty casual approach to this, and if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that what the defendant could have done is develop its own set of pictures and come in with its own diagrams and then show them to this expert and say, well, what about this and what about that? But I mean, there wasn't even anything to work with, was there?
Well, I don't know that there was that to work with. What was to work with is the fact that he couldn't recall specifically which such serrations there were, and that's certainly a basis for cross-examination. I mean, this was physical evidence that if defense counsel had wanted to have another ballistics expert examine it, they certainly could have done that. And
but what did he say that was enough to get it into evidence? We know what he didn't say, but what did he say to support the admission?
Well, as best I can recall the testimony, and Mr. Howard's right, it is a lengthy transcript here. It was a several-day trial. I think he said they were microscopically similar, that the serrations on one shell was microscopically similar to the other six shells, and on that basis he concluded that all seven shells were .45 caliber and fired from the same firearm. And that became significant because four of the shells were found at the scene. The other three were found in the car that Mr. McNally was believed to have been driving.
But he was testifying from memory, correct?
Yes, he was testifying from memory. I think he said, you know, I had microscopically examined these. This was done about 9 months ago, and this was my conclusion. But he didn't have the pictures and things like that. Sometimes I've seen with fingerprint evidence, they put the big fingerprint up there and they point to things. And I've watched some of the testimony, and I can never follow it, but that may be my failing. It is done different ways. Some people have very elaborate productions. Other people, other experts simply testify from memory, and then if they're asked questions, they answer those as best they can. But here,
well, as Justice Berger said, he didn't have a report per se, the way we've seen reports. And as I understand it, this laboratory specializes in ballistic evidence. So it would be hard for anybody to remember everything. But I'm not saying he didn't, but tell us what he had to refresh his recollection. He examined 7 shells. He said, I put them under a microscope. I remembered they matched. Here I am to tell you those are the shells and they matched. Was he going exclusively by memory, or did he have a notation on the bag with the shells in it, or how did he recall this?
Well, I don't recall anything specifically about notation on the evidence packaging or anything like that. It may have been exclusively from memory. I don't think there was any report explicitly introduced for this expert. There was a report as to the other expert with the gunshot residue that her report was actually put into evidence too, although sometimes the objection from defense is, well, that's cumulative. They've already had the witness testify. Why do you have to have the written report too? So I've seen that done both ways as well. Sometimes a report is introduced, and other times the expert simply testifies and is subject to cross-examination.
Well, going back to Justice Berger's other question about photographs and things that we see in other cases, when you have someone like this who testifies, I examine them, they match, here I am to tell you that, and then you say, well, how did you determine they matched? There has to be some protocol. You know, we know from fingerprint evidence you have so many points of comparison, and when you get a threshold, then you're convinced, and the more you get over the threshold, the more convinced you are. In this case, consistent with Fenster, shouldn't you have to say more than, I remember I looked at them under the microscope and they matched?
Well, I don't know for the lands and grooves that it's exactly analogous to the fingerprint. The fingerprint evidence, I think there has to be a certain number of points of comparison, and I can't remember if the standard's 8 or 12 or whatever. There's a certain threshold number. With the lands and grooves, I think it's more a matter of looking at it. Is that mark on this particular item of evidence in the same place as that mark is on another piece? And if it is, then the conclusion is.
Did the witness at the trial say, give some detail about the specifics, you know, of the comparison along the lines that Justice Holland asked, or did the witness just say, well, I don't remember any details, but what I do remember is that I did a very thorough analysis way back when, and at that point I remember concluding that there was a perfect match.
I don't think he ever said perfect match, but I think initially he said that there was a match, and then that testimony was elaborated on. I don't know that how much detail there exactly was. I mean, I don't want to mislead the court by over-characterizing his testimony, but I think the bottom line was he said they matched, and he did have some explanation, but it wasn't an elaborate production, that's for sure.
Let me try to approach this from a different perspective. Let's assume for the moment that this same witness shows up in court with the same lack of backup information and lack of recollection, and defense counsel objected and said, you know, this witness shouldn't be allowed to testify. Wouldn't you agree that that objection should be sustained?
Well, I don't know if it should be sustained. It's probably, and maybe the voir dire suggestion is the best idea, is that the court's going to have to explore what the basis is of the instruction, and the basis of the objection. And then at that point, the judge, exercising the independent gatekeeper function, can decide whether or not that testimony is going to be admissible.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, wouldn't it be better practice for the state to make sure that its experts show up with the necessary information so that if defense counsel were to raise an issue about it, they would be able to say, oh, here are my pictures, here's my report. I can support what I am now testifying about.
Oh, certainly. The more you have, the more ammunition, the better off you are. This fellow, Mr. Roan, actually works for the state police. This was an in-house ballistics examination. The gun residue was sent to, I believe, a laboratory in Pennsylvania, and that was a private company that did that. And obviously, the more information you have, the better off you are. But I don't think, and the problem here is this is all plain error, that none of these objections were made at trial. So, you know, the judge didn't have to explore it any further than he normally would in exercising the independent gatekeeper function. And here, we don't have an explicit ruling because the judge wasn't asked to make an explicit ruling, but in one of the opinions I attached from 4 years earlier, the judge had certainly recognized his responsibility in that regard.
Mr. Williams, I just want to interrupt your train of thought. You only have a little time left on this last issue. The way I understand Mr. Howard's argument, defense counsel made a request for witnesses to be produced by the state, and that a fair reading of their request would have included the person that didn't show up. And notwithstanding that, there were no consequences. So react to my characterization any way you want. First, was there a request? Second, would it normally have encompassed the person that didn't show up? And third, if that's true, why didn't the judge address that?
Well, I'm not sure. I think there probably was a request. I'm not positive about that. The difficulty here is that this is a little different than the drug analysis sort of thing. What Michelle Berry, the missing witness, did was she took the stuff out of storage. It had come in two different kits from the state police for gunshot residue analysis, and she put 8 vials on the scanning electron microscope stage, and there were some control vials too, and then she just pushes a button and they run through overnight. It takes about an hour to analyze each vial. Here, all she does is physically remove them from storage, place them on the tray, or I guess she takes them out and places them on the stage there, and then they run through. It's a mechanical process. The other thing is that Foster, who did testify, said that afterwards she and another chemist there, Frayling, had also independently looked at this stuff, and their conclusions matched what the printouts had been on the electron microscope. So I think any possible error is certainly harmless because there was a further personal examination by the witness who did appear and testify.
Well, McNally's argument seems to be, how do I know she took the evidence for my case out as opposed to somebody else's case?
Well, there wasn't any evidence that anything was confused, and that's one of the problems with the drug evidence, is either it was confused with another sample or there was some evidence of tampering, and there was no testimony about either confusion or the possibility of tampering here. It was just in a storage locker that was secured, taken out, placed on the electron microscope stage.
Well, going back to my initial question about consequences, let's assume you're right, and in the scheme of things, this was close enough. If a defendant makes a request, why should the state unilaterally decide who to bring and who not to bring and think, I've got enough people here to satisfy our view of the chain of evidence, even if the defendant wants everyone?
Well, I think it has to be on a reasonable basis of what each person in the chain does. If the person is simply doing a mechanical job of removing an object from a secured storage area, then placing the object on electron microscope stage and pushing a button, and that's all the person does, that's relatively de minimis.
But you're saying that is a decision the state can make unilaterally, notwithstanding a specific request?
Well, no, I think the judge has to look at it, and if the judge decides, no, this was a crucial person in the chain of custody and you have to produce them or you're not going to admit the evidence, then, you know, that's within the judge's discretion to do that. And if we're wrong and we suffer the consequences. But here it is different than the drug evidence, I think, because it's gunshot residue.
Are you saying this is not a crucial witness, or are you saying that the witness that particular witness wasn't fairly encompassed within the request? I'm not sure what your position is.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this statute that this is based on relates to testing of drugs, and this is testing of gunshot residue. There's swabs that are taken. The swabs in this case were of Mr. McNally's hands, and there were 4 other swabs that were taken of the interior of the vehicle. So I don't think she's a crucial witness, certainly, because she doesn't really do anything other than take them out of the storage and put them on the microscope stage. Second, I don't think she's reasonably encompassed there. She's not the person who's doing the handling like Foster was, who afterwards independently examined and analyzed the stuff with her own eyes, not the microscope.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Yes, you have a minute.
Your Honor, as to the chain of custody issue, this is even more crucial than it would be for drug evidence, because we're talking about microscopic particles, and we're talking about the first individual to expose the samples to the laboratory, in a laboratory that does 90% of its work surrounding gunshot residue. And she didn't just take something out of a container and put it on a stage. She opened eight vials, took the tops off them, held the caps, which contained the substance that was going to be viewed by the electron microscope, in her hands and loaded them into the stage. So making it sound like she had some de minimis role is not the record. Also, with respect to the firearms expert, there are no standards like fingerprints. This is purely subjective pattern matching. What the state did was they brought a witness to trial, and he said he couldn't remember why he made the match. And there was no way to cross-examine him about it. There were no pictures to look at, no diagrams. We're simply stuck with that. And the defense, how would you know in advance that the expert was going to say he couldn't remember how he reached his conclusion?
Thank you. And thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll take a brief recess.